Hey everyone, this is Jenny Schweigert, and you're listening to Keep It Real in Agriculture, a podcast designed for farmers, ranchers, agribusiness professionals, dietitians, those that are working in the food sector, even agriculture enthusiasts. What's the purpose? It's to provide you with examples of how stories are being shared, tackling those tough ag issues, and hopefully, maybe we'll even inspire one of you to share your story. Get ready, because here we go. And we are back to Keeping It Real in Agriculture, and this is part three with our conversation with Brian Hoag of Arable Media. Great to have you back, Brian.
Thank you.
So I want to start today by digging into some of your experiences internationally. You've had many opportunities to see a lot of things that most of us here would never see.
Yeah, I've been fortunate to have a chance to on different occasions and under different circumstances to kind of see what other people and other communities live and how their cultures exist in other parts of the world.
And where are some of the places that you've been that have really kind of stuck out in your mind that are, you know, frozen in time, things that just couldn't believe were happening?
I think we live like 30 minutes, 35 minutes from Mexico. So international has always kind of been a weird, I don't look at it as very international because we live near the border of, you know, our country and obviously Mexico. So, but my first real, what I would consider international experience was when I was a freshman and sophomore in high school. Those two summers I spent with my church in Guatemala, the first summer building helping build a medical clinic, and then the second year working with a team of doctors that were running the medical clinic for the summer. And for me, that was this very eye-opening experience. I still remember to this day on the flight home from out of Guatemala City and looking out the window as we flew out and my heart just being different. I could feel in a way that has only happened a couple times since then was that my heart had changed and I got to see something that I didn't understand. I saw magazines and I probably saw movies or videos of it at that point in my life. But when you see firsthand what some people, the poverty and the challenges that they face on a daily basis, that was the first time that happened. And it's still very, very clear to me. The second time was more recently, and we were in Liberia, Africa, working with the Texas A&M and the Howard Buffett Foundation on a study of farmers, self-sufficient farmers in Liberia. And I remember it was the third or fourth day of this 3-week trip that we were there for, and we rolled into this village, and by all accounts, by everything that you know and that you would expect, like, this is the low of the low. The huts are shanties that are, you know, half mud, half scrap wood. You know that there's, when it rains, it rains inside, even with the roofs, you know, the roofs being that the way they were. It was just a very, very sad place, or what you thought would be a sad place. And we rolled up in our Toyota Land Cruisers and whatnot in this little convoy, and we get out and there's kids everywhere, barefoot, you know, barely clothed, running around, and they were having so much fun. They were playing with, at the time, I think they were playing with a water bottle, an empty water bottle, most likely a water bottle from a previous nonprofit NGO that was, you know, there. But it was an empty water bottle, and they were kicking it around, and you couldn't tell the difference, the amount of enjoyment and happiness that were on their face playing with that bottle. You couldn't tell whether that child was kicking a water bottle or was going through the gates of Disneyland for the first time. Like, there was no separation of like, wow, this is fun, but this is way more fun. Like, it was all in the same. And I just remember of seeing that and having this aha moment of context of how, you know, this blessing that the Lord, I think, has given us with this idea of context, that when we don't know what we don't know, it can't bring us down. Now, that doesn't, I don't want to minimize the real challenges that those kids face. I mean, they are happy at that moment right now, playing with that water bottle, but there is no doubt that they go to bed far too many nights with pain in their stomach, and their understanding of loss is far greater than ours in the fact that many of their siblings they will see pass away long before they should. And so I don't want to minimize that, but for that moment, those children didn't know that they were in a country that had been, you know, torn to pieces by a 30-year civil war, and they didn't understand how hungry or how full the rest of the world is on most days comparative to them. And so those are the two moments that really, from an international experience, changed me. And I was, you know, thankful and that I got to experience those.
Which is incredible, because it sounds like their hearts were maybe just as full of joy than those of us that have never been exposed to anything like that.
Yeah, and absolutely.
It really puts things in perspective. How do we get that story, you know, to children that are, you know, middle school or even younger here in the U.S.? Is that something that they would even, I know I'm constantly, when my kids are complaining about food, I'm constantly, you know, there's children that only get to eat twice a day and all they get to eat is rice. Mm-hmm. And I don't, you know, that just kind of goes over their head. How can we get a story like what you have seen into the U.S.?
I mean, I think if we're lucky enough, it's not scalable. It's definitely not realistic, but to provide some of those opportunities for young people to see that, and hopefully that when they come back, they share that experience and they light a fire with under their friends, and then it's a slow burn as that understanding and interest grows. But that's obviously very expensive, and it's difficult to scale and replicate. And at the same time, I think we need to be very careful. I'm very, very careful. And I'm not saying that I'm one that's above that and haven't unintentionally done this where we go to international experiences for us rather than for them. Mm-hmm. You know, we want to feel that emotion. We want to see that, we want to feel our hearts change, and we want those experiences. And I think it's a balance, and I don't think anybody does it intentionally, but we think we probably do need to think intentionally about how we do trips like that and how do we experience it. So it's not a sightseeing visit, that it's mm-hmm. you know, here's how the other way the world works, so that you feel better at home and that you get to talk to your friends as somebody who's, you know, cultured and experienced and traveled and, you know, philanthropic and yada, yada, yada. Like, Can we do both? Can we help them, and still feed that within our soul? But specifically to children, though, I think for me, this is where it's exciting from somebody who owns a media company, is how do we provide those experiences that's scalable? And I think, and I hope that some of that is through technology. How do we, you know, virtual reality is becoming a real thing, a commercially viable. It's becoming cheaper and cheaper every day, where we can put on a helmet, a VR helmet, and really change the environment that we're in. And I think that could be a really cool tool in the next 5 years, where schools have the ability that every classroom has a set of those. And they, you know, when we're talking about hunger and we're talking about what that looks like, we're able to take children, you know, and students, and we're able to take them there through media. And so I think that's an exciting frontier for us. I think that's a place where it's scalable, that it's financially feasible. Mm-hmm. And sure, it will never replace the moment when you're down on your knees and you're handing a little Guatemalan little girl a sour apple sucker that you brought from the United States. That you can't replicate that as of right now. But I'm hopeful Apple and Google and Facebook and all those are working on that. But that's something that's hard to replace. But you can get about 75% the way there with some media and some of the technology that we see today. So I think I'm hopeful that that's where we're at. I'm pretty dang bullish on the idea that the world is getting better and technology is going to help us do that. And the world that we live in today is the best world that has ever existed. And it's only going to get better. And sure, we have blips on the map that make us question that. And we have elected leaders at times that make us drastically question whether this is the best days of our country or this world. But all in all, I think I'm very bullish on the future. And I think we will figure out ways not only to help young people have those experiences, but far more importantly, I think we will figure out ways that we eliminate the need for those experiences to be understood. And that's, providing hunger relief and sustainability and agriculture so that those young people can not only feed themselves, but they also create markets and vibrance and economies that, are not in need of the Western culture's interference.
And you really, that gives me a lot of hope. And I hadn't thought about virtual reality being used in that context. And that's a great idea.
I think that's all that's for that specific example. But I think VR in general and AR, augmented reality, really provide an opportunity to do a lot of things. Now we're talking the most drastic of situations, and I hope we use it for those methods first, and then we utilize it for others where we take, we're able to help open the eyes of a 14-year-old about what the rest of the world looks like, both in their beauty as well as the challenges that exist in this world. But at the same time, from a much more less important vantage point, is that consumers and can understand better what the beauty and the challenges that exists in rural America and vice versa, so that people can understand in rural America can put on a headset and be transformed to
urban.
To the urban lifestyle and the wonderful gifts and beauty and challenges that exist in those environments. So I think these technologies really have an opportunity to bridge those gaps and to provide understanding and situational awareness of what other people in the world, whether it's in your state or in your country or across the world, and I don't think it's that far off in a different planet. I think the technology is going to allow us to experience all of that.
So that's a great upcoming tool we hope to see sooner than later to connect our different cultures, urban and rural. From your standpoint and what you've seen from farmers, ranchers, agribusiness professionals, and enthusiasts, do you believe that ag advocacy is reaching the right audiences?
At times, I think, a general statement is hard to say because there's hundreds, if not thousands, of programs and initiatives that different pieces of the organization or the industry are trying to engage. And so I think some of them are hitting pretty well, and I think there's some that are not. What I do really appreciate about our industry, though, is that we're constantly trying, and mm-hmm. And I think that's a step in the right direction, that we know we need to engage. We understand the value that it'll bring. We might be a little late to the game of starting those conversations, and I mean decades late, not months or years. We're understanding that better now, and so I think we're on the right track, and we're just trying to figure out what pieces work, and there is no silver bullet. I don't think there's a silver bullet for very many things in this world, and I think ag advocacy is no different in that. Something that works here in Arizona to connect with the consumer from our farms in Yuma that grow a lot of fresh produce to the urbanites that live in Scottsdale, that may work here, but it may completely fail, you know, in another part of the country doing this, trying to do the same thing. So there's no one thing that we can do. I think it's just this idea of empathy, of trying to understand where the other side is coming from and trying to engage with them. So one of the things that I think one of the things that would help us, I think, do a better job is all of us come to terms with the fact that consumers don't need us. They do not need farmers. And I understand that that's probably a pretty brazen and blunt thing to say, and probably goes against about every commodity organization, farm organization's PR communication strategy for the last 30 years. But I don't believe they do. And I think that attitude that we have and that that belief is really counterintuitive and counterproductive to us really having engaging, insightful conversations and engagements with the rural audience. Because of technology, the same technology that allow us, a 14-year-old in Wilcox, Arizona, to experience the tragedies and beauty of the African nation, those same technologies and technology in general are allowing us to produce food in ways that we thought was completely science fiction. And if we're not careful, we will push the consumer. We will continue to push the consumer further and further away from us, where they don't need us. And I think we have to be very, very careful about that. And that may not be something that happens in this generation. It may not be something that I see in my lifetime. But I don't think any organization, any industry, any technology that ever thinks that they're entitled to somebody else's value, or to be valued in some way, are the ones that are the most quickly replaced.
But wait a minute. In the middle of the winter, I'm lambing, and I have to go outside 3-4 o'clock in the morning and bundled up, and I'm freezing, and my fingers are freezing, and I have a lamb, you know, that's about to die. And don't they get that? I mean, they need us. Don't they get what we're going through?
If they want a lamb from your place, maybe. There's alternative meats today, you know, that are lab grown, that do not require you to bundle up in a jacket, and it doesn't require a lamb to be harvested to produce that food. And so those are the real things that are happening. That is not science fiction, Star Wars. Those are things that are happening. Mayonnaise, believe it or not, made without eggs. I mean, these are real things that are happening out there. And so we need to be aware of it. And I don't think at the end of the day, I don't believe the consumer is looking for that. I don't believe that that's their ultimate goal, is to not have the rural lifestyle and the agriculture sector that produces food. I don't believe that's what they're after. I'm sure that there are some, for sure. But I don't think that's what they're after. But if we're not careful in the way that we approach them and the way that we engage with them, we give them sometimes no other options to think of us differently, and try to find ways to not engage, you know, utilize our products. But the thing is we forget all too often. This industry forgets customers. My business, I cannot go to any one of my clients and tell them that they need me. They have to use me. It is imperative to the future of their success that they have to use me, because I will be laughed out of that boardroom. I'll be laughed out of that meeting, and I will be barred from ever actually engaging with that client ever again. And for some reason, we've had that tone that when we talk to our customers, the consumer is our customer. We are providing. We are not a society that of communism or where we're, you know, that the government creates food and then feeds to its people. Like, this is a free market. They have options. They don't have to utilize us. And so I think we forget that sometimes, that the consumers are our customers. And the same way they would never, ever engage with, you know, other customers in their business life. Why we attempt to do that with the consumer is sometimes beyond me.
And I was being dramatic with that, you know, it happens, but it only happens, you know, for a month and a half, 2 months. And I always think about our garbage man and all of the different elements that he works in to pick up our garbage every Wednesday. I'm sure that, you know, he freezes his tail off in the winter. And I'm sure that, you know, on a day like we've had the last couple days, you know, he is just sweating like no other. And I think it's important to realize we need people like our garbage men just as much as someone needs us. And we need to all bring those expectations down to the same level.
Totally agree.
Now that we've kind of covered advocacy and we've kind of talked about struggles, tell us a little bit about the ranch today, your role and your father's role.
Well, it's a farm now. So I grew up on a farm and ranch, when I was like eight, we moved off the ranch and purchased a pecan farm and then sold that years later, and now have a hay farm. That hay farm is in Wilcox, which I'm in Gilbert, Arizona. It's in Wilcox, Arizona, so about 3.5 hours from each other. And as I mentioned on our first part of the podcast, my dad a little less than 2 years ago had a pretty severe stroke that left him unable to really do any of the daily activities that he was able to do prior to the stroke. So he's luckily, we're real fortunate, he's able to get around pretty good at times on a walker. But he can't drive. He can't get in a tractor. And there's also been there's been some mental as well as physical challenges that have happened due to the stroke. And so that left us in kind of a pickle because my dad was helping manage the farm before the stroke. And so we've had a couple neighbors who've stepped up. My ag teacher from high school who left being an ag teacher after about 2 years, he went back to farming. And it's funny how the world came around. My ag teacher, who I was always so thankful for my FFA experience, then kind of represented into my life again in a far more important part, you know, being able to manage our farm for us since I'm about 3.5 hours away. So we kind of partner on that, and he helps, you know, the daily activities of keeping the hay, the alfalfa hay irrigated and cut and marketed. And so it was really, really helpful in the days and the weeks, months following my dad's stroke when we were in the hospital every day and we were hoping dad was going to make it at times, that, you know, we had those friends who stepped up and essentially saved our operation until we're able to sell it. So I try to get down there once a month, at least, and conversations, hopefully more often than that, about what's going on the farm and how we can do it. And now it's running far more smoother than it did a year ago, now that kind of everybody's roles are kind of understood and we have an understanding and an agreement of, you know, how the farm operates. But yeah, it was a difficult time. And, as I'd mentioned, I didn't ever think I would farm again, return to the farm, and I kind of quasi did, and I guess in a way that is most appropriate for me. And so yeah, it's been a challenge, but we're thankful that my dad's still with us, and we're thankful for the friends who have stepped up. And then the other really neat part of this whole experience is, I mean, as I shared, my dad has had such a huge influence in me, and mm-hmm. in my passions and who I am. And agriculture is just core to my DNA. And so I've always, that's just always been there. And then through this stroke with my dad, I have gotten to understand the strength and the perseverance and the love that my mom has, and that I probably didn't nearly appreciate before. That is a silver lining through this, is I've got to see my mom in a whole different view, and I grossly underestimated the power of that woman prior to this crisis that we had in our family. And so I would never wish, if I could take my dad's stroke back, I would, but that's not an option. And I'm pretty thankful that the relationship that my mom and I have now because of that. We're a little two-man team on this deal and on this endeavor, and it's made us a lot closer, and it's hard to think of not having that relationship with her now in the way that we do.
Something that we had talked about in part two is that emotion is something that we can all connect on.
And to be honest, I think some of our goals should be not looking at the world in a non-ag, non-farm way, you know, like, I don't think I view the world that way. And that's not because I'm like intentional. When I think about my dad's stroke and I think about the challenges that my family has had since then and the way that people react to him, now that he's, you know, he's different than he was before. I think about all the times that I wasn't nearly as sensitive and nearly as caring to other people who had similar challenges, whether it was a tragedy like a stroke or a death or, you know, a setback of some sort. And I don't look at it as whether they were non-ag or non-ag. I look at it as It's those situations that change you. Just like Guatemala changed my heart, my dad's stroke has changed my heart and changed the way that I look at things. And it's not perfect. In no way, shape, or form is this a soapbox that I'm somehow figured out life. But I feel like I got a little closer to understanding a lot of people that I didn't understand before. And hopefully I'm a little bit more kind and a little bit more caring to people, farm, non-farm, just any walk of life. You know, I feel like I can relate to them in some way that prior to I couldn't, you know, and I often talked about that with speeches. After FFA, they want you to give speeches, and I hated speeches. Gosh, I'm bad at them. And two, I always was like, I don't know what I'm going to talk about. Like, I have a great life. I have two parents that still love each other dearly. I've never gone to bed hungry. I've never fought cancer. I've got all my limbs attached. What in the world am I going to talk about that, you know, that is? And so I've always felt really lucky to have that perspective that it's been a pretty good life. And so the downside of that is sometimes I didn't understand nearly the challenges of other people that weren't so fortunate. And so that's opened my eyes and hopefully opened my heart a little bit to understand other people's struggles and their challenges. So,
and I am just as guilty as anyone labeling and looking at it as ag and non-ag. And so you've really opened my eyes and opened my heart to look at things in a different perspective. So I appreciate that.
You bet.
Well, thank you for joining us on all three of the parts of our interview. And I hope that maybe in a year or so we can come back and we can talk a little bit more about virtual reality and technology.
I would hopefully be in a Arable will have you know, been listed on the stock exchange at that point, and will be you know, hundreds if not thousands of employees around the world. So yeah, in a year or two, let's touch base again and see where we're at. So
definitely. And for the listeners, if you have not been out there to see some of the videos and the creations that have been created by Arable, I highly recommend it, especially the Plant 17 video. And that, I believe, is on Vimeo, correct?
Yeah, it's on Vimeo. The easiest way to find all of our videos is via our Facebook page. So it's just www.facebook.com/ArableTV.
Well, thank you again very much.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for joining us again this week. Brian has so much to share about his life's work. If you've missed his other episodes, you can go onto SoundCloud and iTunes. Episode 008 talks about the documentary that his company created. The company is Arable Media. They created a documentary about the wildfires that we saw this spring out west. Episode 007, Brian talks about his experience working for President Bush and on ag policy, which is super interesting. Go ahead and follow us at Keeping Ag Real on Twitter and Facebook. And if you want to find me, you can look for me at Jen Schweigert. Until next time, keep it real.